This is Rumblestrip. I'm Erica Heilman.
Confession. The month is only 2 days old, and already we have seen a circus and ridden a bicycle together. I wish I had never told a lie in my life.
That's Garrett Kaiser back in the summer of 2019, reading one of his poems in a field in the late summer in the Northeast Kingdom. We drove around the kingdom that day talking about poetry and Lake Willoughby and fishing spots.
Look at that hedge. That's a commitment. Look.
That is the mother of all hedges. We have a beautiful day for a drive, don't we?
Garrett's written a number of books. He writes for Harper's Magazine and Mother Jones and a bunch of others, and he worked for a number of years as a high school English teacher in the Northeast Kingdom. He's one of the only writers where I find myself copying whole passages down from his work, like I will need them later. I write these passages down because they remind me of something fundamental about being human that I don't want to forget. When we met, he had just come out with a book of poetry called The World Pushes Back. So I asked him if he would go for a drive and stand in a field and read poetry. And he did. And it was a perfect day for a drive. To start, I asked him why so many people these days are intimidated by poetry. Here's Garrett Kaiser.
So, why are people scared of poetry?
Well, I think there are a few reasons that people are afraid of poetry. First of all, in a utilitarian, production-driven capitalist society, any pursuit done for its own sake, with no monetary reward, is going to be suspect. I think that some people have been ruined for poetry by what's done to it in their education. So, you know, they sit down to do a poetry unit in their English class and are made to memorize and recite long passages and are made to analyze language in strained and strenuous ways. That would kill it for some people, and as a former teacher, I may bear some guilt for that. And I think there's a question of, did the people abandon poetry, or did the poets abandon the people? You know, when poetry became a pursuit for the academy, when poetry readings moved from the bar room to the university lecture hall, when we had poets in the rise of modernism who were almost made uneasy if an average person could figure out what in the hell they were talking about, it's a question akin to what gets asked whenever there's been a divorce. You know, who started this? You know, who cheated on whom? Who was the first person to turn cold? But it may also be a case of just suspecting art and suspecting intelligence itself as somehow weak and unworthy. Anyway, enough pontification.
Or weak and unworthy, or just without value.
Right. It doesn't contribute to anything. One of my favorite passages, which, like most passages I quote, will probably be garbled by my bad memory, but William Carlos Williams says, "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." You know, what do you learn from a poem? What good is it? But it's good. Partly lies in the fact that there's no quick and easy answer to that question of what good is it, you know? What good is playing a board game with your kid in his pajamas on the edge of his bed, you know? I mean, it doesn't make any money, it doesn't cure cancer, it doesn't contribute to the gross national product. Maybe one of the things that poetry does is help to remind us of how many lovely, unpaid, unpriced things are of surpassing value and need to be cherished. But I hope that answers your question.
It does.
Yeah. You can get a nice ice cream here, too, sometimes.
Traveling light. The older I get, the less I'm bothered by seeming incongruity. I read the Gospel of Mark, listening to Billie Holiday. A young man runs away naked from the Garden of Gethsemane, and Billy sings, "I'm traveling light." Eventually, you find the rhyme for every word. The night is coming. Perhaps that's why the color that goes with everything.
Do you ever worry, or this is something I think about a lot when I'm making my show, is sentimentalizing the place where I live? I mean,
sentimentality is always a danger, and so is its twin. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said sentimentality is the bank holiday of cynicism. And you know, I have propensities probably for both. But on the other hand, I'm not as quick as some others to damn all sentiment as sentimentality. You can become so cool that you're afraid to feel. And I refuse to be that cool. And if somebody wants to put me down for sentimentality, just stick around and I'll give you enough cold-hearted rage to qualify your judgments. But if I'm feeling affectionate about a place or the people I live with, maybe it's because they deserve to be loved. And maybe it's because they've kept my heart from getting harder than it might otherwise have gotten.
This road looks like it was just redone.
Yeah, it does.
Must have been a big trial.
Yeah, we could go on Route 5 parallel to this, and you would think that all the fillings were coming loose from your teeth. And I maintain in my perverse quasi-Marxist way that the reason for that is because the real estate along that road is less pricey, and so it takes a little while longer for the road to be paved. You'll notice I've not said don't quote me on that.
Wolf Hall. It will take a little courage to finish this book that I do not want to end. I ration the pages as on certain nights I ration love, but passion draws us on. This life too, my woods, my work, to see the garden through to the stripped harvest. I can't even imagine my last look at the sea. But we must see the story to its end. Our passion draws us on. We lust for the finish. It takes courage to live, they tell me, which is true, though some of it comes down to the courage not to.
Well, then, yeah, you'd sort of hate the question that...
No, go ahead, ask.
I mean, that what... It does faith have to do with writing for you?
Well, that's a very complex question, but it's an essential question, and I could never hate that question without hating my life itself. As the late Lou Reed says in one of his songs, you need a busload of faith to get by, and you do, whether you have conventional religious faith or not. You need the faith that you're able to make some sense through words. You need the faith that somebody is going to find enjoyment or value in the words you write, that you can even be worthy of whatever little gift you have. You know, we all have a gift, but we can let the gift down. I'm very fond of a quotation by Tony Bennett, who, when asked whether he had ever tried marijuana, said that he never had for fear that he would be sinning against his talent. And the quote sticks in my mind, not so much because, you know, he didn't want to try marijuana or he decided not to, but rather that he had that sense of his talent as something that could be sinned against, which on the one hand sounds like incredible arrogance or hubris or ego, and on the other hand is expressive of the most sublime humility, that I have been given a talent and that I could, by a decision of mine, sin against that talent. So it takes faith to believe your talent, whatever it is worthy enough that it could be sinned against. And I think a lot of people get in trouble in this world because they don't believe they have any talent that could be sinned against, or even any personal value that could be sinned against. The beginning of sanity is the recognition that we are holy. And it takes a hell of a lot of honesty and humility to admit that to yourself and then to act on it. It's so much easier to believe that you're defiled and dirty and then just to do whatever the hell you want than to actually recognize that you are sacred. And, you know, part of that is that you need to respect yourself and other people need to respect you. Faith grows out of that sense that we don't see everything clearly. Faith grows out of the recognition that some things can only be grasped by faith. They can't be produced by a scientific experiment. They can't be demonstrated by your accountant with double entry bookkeeping, that there are aspects of reality that elude that. And that means that the value of what you have to say is also somewhat out of your hands, and you have to trust that the justification of what you've done is not your affair. You know, as Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, that, you know, you have to let go of the effects and really do what your duty is. And I learned that teaching. I learned that teaching when I learned that you might think you had a profound influence on a student's life and another student you may scarcely remember. But it's that second student who comes to you 15 years later and says, you know, you said something in English class that changed my life. And you don't remember, you scarcely remember the student. You don't remember saying that thing, but that was a value. And other things maybe you thought were a value were not. A man wrote me a letter about my least favorite book and told me that it helped him through a terrible time in his life that followed the accidental shooting of his daughter by police officers. And I thought to myself, you know what? I don't think it's such a hot book, but I'm glad I wrote it and now I know why. But often you don't know why. So you saddle up your horse, you put the key in the ignition, and you get going. And that is the Aldrich's General Store, which was a store. Look at those light bulbs. I love those light bulbs. The details. If God is love and God is in the details, then love is in the details too, is in the way I trim these crabgrass tassels after mowing your father's lawn. Two kids kiss on a dark back porch and a lawn gets mowed 30 years later. Love makes the world go round. Love makes the world.
That was Garrett Kaiser, back in the summer of 2019. Garrett is the author of 9 books. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and Virginia Quarterly Review. His poems, essays, and short stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Lapham's Quarterly, and a number of others. You can find links to some of his recent work at vermontpublic.org/rumblestrip. Music for this show is by callous Vermont musician Brian Clark. Rumblestrip is distributed on the radio by Vermont Public. This is Erica Heilman. I'll be back next week. Thanks a lot for listening.